So welcome, everyone. Let's see, my computer says that it's January 10th. So look at that. We've already gotten through 10 days of this year. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's reality. So at least as far as time is real. But let's not get into that again. We're going to meditate for about 20 minutes. And I'm gonna get you started, and then I'm gonna push you out into the meditative world on your own. There's no sinking in meditation. Well, but I was gonna say to sink or swim, but let's just say to breathe. So. Settling back into your meditation posture, whatever really supports you in your meditation. Typically, sort of an ideal of an upright posture. But we can also meditate effectively lying down if need be. It's just that's, more risky in terms of getting sleepy. And sleepiness is one of the challenges, can be one of the challenges of meditation. So sitting and trying to come into just a sense of stillness. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. We're really, starting by stepping out of the visual world and the visual sense so that we can tune in more easily to our felt experience, to our mental experience. So just beginning by tuning into your body, how you're holding your body, like quite striking that sometimes just by trying to be mindful of your body, you start to notice subtle and even not so subtle things that are going on. It might be just the way you're holding your shoulders or your tension in your face. Maybe you're not really sitting in a balanced way, so you realize you need to align the body a bit. So just tuning into all these elements of the body, letting it settle and relax, center. And as you do that, feeling the breath moving in the body. As we come into stillness, we might notice that the breath keeps moving. We can think of this initial stage of a meditation period as a kind of arrival. Just arriving in the body, arriving in the present moment, arriving with the breath. You might notice just how you're feeling or what your mood is. What your energy is like. Then beginning to focus more intently on the breath. So we use the breath as our anchor, as our object of meditation. You can feel the sensations of breathing at the nostrils. Air passing in and out. Or you could focus on the movement of the belly, rising, falling. Or there's a sense of just resting with the breath. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to figure out. Can I just be with the experience of breathing, this primal activity? Being with the breath, as simple as it is, staying with it turns out to be challenging. Our minds aren't used to the simplicity of just being with a sensation. Being with this very simple biological movement. So very often the mind will run off. Might go into some memory or some plan. Might start thinking about the breath, thinking about meditating, which is not meditating. So our task is to bring the attention back. And oftentimes that's the job we do over and over. Just coming back to the breath. And with that persistence, we may find a bit of calm. To some extent, that calm depends upon our reaction to the wandering mind. Do we become frustrated? Do we judge ourselves? Or do we see that wandering as just another natural behavior, just like breathing? The body breathes, the mind thinks. It's the job of the mind, not a mistake. And so we bring acceptance, kindness, patience, trust, there is no single outcome from our efforts in meditation. It's not that each time we meditate, we will get on some conveyor belt that takes us to calm and insight. Indeed, sometimes this will be the result. Other times, become sleepy, dull, or restless, agitated, bored, lost in fantasies or dream realms. And we can't count on some result, and neither should we expect that. Mindfulness is not about controlling our experience, but observing, watching it unfold. Well, I went off into a thinking about the fact that we're coming up on 3 years since the arrival of COVID on our shores here, and what we sort of thought was going to come of that. And if someone had told us that 3 years in, we'd still be dealing with it, we probably would have been more upset than we already were. But one just doesn't have to deal with 3 years at a time, right? We only have to deal with one day at a time. So here we are today. And I'm glad people are still showing up, you know. A lot has been lost, and some things have been gained. One of the obvious things that has been gained is this online opportunity to be together that we didn't really realize was a potential a few years ago. It was very nice. As I said, I taught on Saturday in Oakland, and it was wonderful to be with people. And there, there's Zoom is not a replacement for that by any means. But there were only 15 people, you know. It's like, I mean, that's great. That was plenty, but they all had to drive there from somewhere or take a transit, and you guys didn't have to leave home. So, in any case, it's everything keeps changing. That's about it. So I said beforehand that I was going to talk a little bit about, and I'm going to read from this book. I have to find the page I wanted to read. Okay. So it's called Being Nature, A Down-to-Earth Guide to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And this was originally published as Buddha's Nature. Back in 1998. And so I want to talk a little bit about Wes Nisker, the author. He is sort of known, he's something of a wit, a comic of sorts, court jester of the counterculture, and so he worked as a journalist for KSAN back in the 70s, and sort of alternative news as opposed to fake news. It was like real news. It's like real people news. But he had started to do Buddhist meditation back in the late 60s, maybe 1970. And so knew and was in India with Jack Kornfield and, well, not Jack, but with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg. Jack wasn't really in India at that time. He was in Thailand. Although he may have gone to India, I don't have his full biography in front of me. But in any case, so Wes kind of goes back to these very early days of the insight meditation, the Vipassana movement. But he never really set out to be a teacher. He was more of a writer and, as I said, a reporter. And then he started a magazine called Inquiring Mind, which is still a fantastic resource. They've digitized many of their back issues that go back to the 80s, and they have interviews with like every famous Dharma teacher of the last 40 years. And but eventually, and then he, I think in the early 90s or late 80s, he did a book called Crazy Wisdom, which was a collection of a lot of quotes and kind of commentaries on the sort of, you know, the tradition of crazy wisdom, which is something really really valuable, because it's kind of the, again, kind of the court jester. It's the thing that kind of tries to pull the covers off of people's, you know, looking good or their pretensions. And that was a very successful book. But around that time, I think Jack Kornfield told Wes he should be a meditation teacher formally. And so he went through one of Jack's early teacher training programs, and part of his the requirements of that was for him to start a meditation group. So he started a group in Berkeley Wednesday nights at the First Presbyterian Church on College Avenue, and I have happened to find out about it. And he started it around 93 or 94, and I found out about it right near the beginning of it. I met someone on a retreat who told me about it, and I had was living in Berkeley. And so I started to go, and I just immediately felt a tremendous rapport and connection with Wes, you know, because he doesn't take things too seriously, let's put it that way, you know. And he had this approach to Dharma that was very kind of refreshing and innovative, and then he had this increasing kind of interest in the science of both meditation, but sort of evolution and physics, and kind of putting all these things together. And he would bring all these things into his Dharma talks. And then eventually he started to write this book. So I used to go to his classes every week. Wednesdays I'd go to his class, and Thursday I'd go to James Barras's class. And besides all of my retreat experience, those two teachers and their weekly classes through the 90s were kind of my teacher training, just watching them, watching how they taught and learning from them. And it was a tremendous opportunity to have these two really wonderful and very contrasting teachers. If you know James Barras, did I even say his name? okay, good. He wrote a book called Awaken Joy, but he's one of the founders of Spirit Rock, and he's been teaching since the late 70s. And a wonderful teacher, but very different personality from Wes. So it was great getting it. I think it's really helpful to hear the Dharma from very different perspectives, because when you only hear it from one perspective, you start to think that's the way it is. And anytime you get an idea like this is the way it is, it tends to close your mind to the broader perspective. And also, if you're going to find the Dharma for yourself, it's really good to see that, oh, there isn't one way, you know, because when you're meditating, you're like, what's going on? You know, I don't know if you ever had that feeling, but when it's like, what is it? It doesn't seem like my brain is following the instructions that the teacher was giving. Like, what is wrong with me? You know? And so to hear different teachers and realize, oh, there's different ways to understand this and different ways to work with this and different approaches is very helpful. So I really encourage you to, you know, to explore the range of teachers and find people that resonate for you, and also to explore people that don't resonate for you, and sort of what is it about that, and is there still something you can get from them even though you don't sort of feel drawn to them. Sometimes the people that annoy you will be the ones you learn the most from. Anyway, so Wes started writing this book, and he would just read as he was writing it. He would bring it to the class and read it to us, and you know. So I fell in love with the book before it was a book, And when it came out, it did not get the kind of response that I think he hoped for, and certainly that I wanted people to get. And I think that's partly because of who he was, that people weren't really ready to take him seriously as a Dharma teacher, because they thought he was sort of a, you know, a sit-down comic, as he would say, you know. But he's a quite brilliant and innovative teacher. So, and I'll say one more thing before I read from this, that this is the first book I know of that took suttas and quoted suttas and did teachings out of the suttas. And that cover, and it's about the four foundations of mindfulness, which, like, these days, those are two things that are, there's a huge interest in, but this is 24 years ago, you know, when very few people really knew anything about them. So I'm going to read from the section on the chapter 4, the first foundation of mindfulness. And you'll hear his voice in here and his humor that comes through along with the very deep Dharma. And the Buddha understood if we are going to experience the roots of our identity, we need to start with the most elemental aspect of our being, the body. In the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, he begins the sequence of meditations with the instructions: having gone into the forest or to the root of a tree or in it to an empty place, one should abide contemplating the body as body, both internally and externally. Exploring the nature of our physical existence is the Buddha's first foundation of mindfulness and the beginning of our practice of evolutionary wisdom. Contemplating the body as body does not mean contemplating my body. In another teaching text, the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha says, "This body does not belong to you or to anyone else. It is the result of previous activity, and for now it should be felt." The Buddha is explaining that this body is not our creation nor choosing, but arises out of a long process of multiple causes and conditions, what today we might call evolutionary adaptation. The Buddha is telling us to dive into the body and feel it, to become intimate with it from head to toe and inside out. Through that exploration, we will now come to know the body as an organic process, as coexistent with the elements of nature and all of earth life. We will realize that my body is not really mine. It's a loner. It is evolution's body. Come to think of it, I don't remember ordering the body I got. No catalog of choices was offered. Sometimes, while meditating on the body, I can feel that the fact that I am indeed a medium-sized mammal, I can feel the fact that I am indeed a medium-sized mammal. I am also a vertebrate, and so are you. To experience this for yourself, just grind your teeth together for a few seconds and feel the shape of your skull. We humans share a bone structure with all the chewers on the planet. We have hinged jaw and teeth. Our skeleton has been formed by 500 million years of continual adaptations, and its bony shape is encoded in the whorls of our genes. We don't own this body. It grows out of the life that has preceded us. In his teachings, the Buddha gave several reasons why the body cannot be regarded as mine or self. And the simplest one is that we don't have control over the body. In the Discourse on the Characteristics of Non-Self, the Anatta Lankhana Sutta, the Buddha explains, were it self, the body would not suffer affliction, and one could have of body what one wished, saying, let my body be this, let my body be that. We can't will our body to change its features, and we can't stop it from being tired, feeling pain, growing sick, aging, or dying. The body has a life of its own. But the body does not have an independent existence either. For one thing, it is made up of trillions of cells that have their own destiny to work out, and it depends on trillions of bacterial organisms now doing their own metabolic thing in your mouth, stomach, and intestines. The life of your body also depends heavily on the earth, at least as a place to lie down on and catch a nap, and also on the heat of the sun to keep you warm and energized. Not least of all, your body's life is nothing without the fuel of oxygen, and therefore could not exist without the atmosphere. Your body's most obvious and intimate connection to the world is through one of our primary sources of energy and the very medium through which we move, the air. So the next section is about breathing, as you might guess. It's called breath. But I'll leave it there for now. And because the other thing that is obvious about this, that's striking about this book, is that it's also something of a forerunner in the area of bringing science in with Buddhism, right? Which is, again, another area that's become very popularized. But before Wes, I think the only book I knew that was really science and Dharma was the Tao of Physics, which was not a Buddhist book, but was, you know, exploring kind of spiritual and Eastern ideas and through this lens of physics. But Wes is going right into the Dharma and really taking it apart in this really, really interesting. I hope you find that interesting. I find it incredibly interesting. You know, because obviously he's not teaching us the sciences. I learn a lot about science in this book, but it's not that the end purpose isn't, so you can learn about science, but it's so that you can have these insights that will inform your practice, because it's really, really helpful. This idea, as you're sitting to realize, this is just nature happening. It's not me. It's not my story. This is not my body. And seeing where it comes from and having that as a kind of container for your practice, I find very helpful. It's kind of something that I fall back on when I need to be reminded, don't take this so personally. Or, you know, yeah, it's my body, I have to deal with it, but, you know, don't think that you're going to get out of it what you want, or that there's something wrong with you when something goes wrong with your body. You know, we do that stuff, right? Like, why am I sick, or why do I look like this, whatever, like some story that we take it also personally. And he really reminds us that we're just like this, we're just part of the wave of evolution. And we're, you know, in this moment, you know, we are on the front of that wave of evolution, but, you know, we will die and then others will just carry it on. Life will continue. So I'm like getting back into reading this book for the first time in like 20 years and getting a lot out of it and enjoying it a lot. It was sort of, you know, when I thought, maybe I'll read from this book today, it was kind of a relief to step away from always reading from my own books. Like, well, there's lots of other good books out there that I don't have to just depend on my own stuff. And sometimes I get uncomfortable always working with my own material. So, yeah, I mean, I do I have more to say? I'll talk a little bit more and then open it up. reading this, because I was reading this morning before my own morning sit, and remembering a moment that was back sort of around this, earlier than this, in the early 90s, 93 or 94. So I was in graduate school in Irvine, and I had a little apartment over a garage, cute little place, as you know, on Balboa Island, which is this man-made island in the Newport Harbor, and very pleasant. At the end of the semester, I was still connected to Berkeley, but I would, at the end of a semester, I would sometimes take a few days and just stay there and do a self-retreat in my apartment. And there's one moment that I remember really distinctly, and those of you who have been on retreats know how this is, that there, you'll have these little just moments that stay with you. The house, there was a house in front and a garage behind the house. And then there was a kind of courtyard, because it was the whole property was fenced in, all that. It was like everybody had their own fences, you know, there. And there was brick there that I could do walking meditation on. And I think probably the house was like somebody's summer house. So there was never anyone there. So I had this space and I was doing walking meditation. The bricks have nothing to do with it, except that they're part of the image of my memory that brings me into that moment. And whether I was standing or walking, I don't know, but I was reflecting on not self. And it just struck me. Maybe I wasn't even reflecting on that self. I was just aware that the breath that I was encased with, not the breath, that air, that the atmosphere, that I'm encased in that it's always right up against my skin, that there's no separation between me and the atmosphere. And it was a moment of seeing not self, that is the non-separate self, that I am not separate from nature, from air, from the atmosphere, that I can never be a separate in some kind of space in which I'm not in contact with some other, you know, elements. And it's one of the, you know, it's even explaining that doesn't seem to, like, I don't know if it sounds like anything, but it was very striking for me and very helpful, because it can be difficult to kind of get this idea, yeah, I'm not separate, but I am, aren't I? Like, there's nobody else here right now, you know, but then just this idea that, oh yeah, the environment itself, I'm contained within that. And so I was thinking of that as I was reading this, because of how Wes is pointing to that, our interdependence, our interexistence with everything, and that the talking about the, you know, this, the way we breathe in, you know, we breathe in something that we think of as not self, the air. Like, the air out there isn't me. But then when I breathe it in for that moment, it's me. And then I breathe it out, and whatever I breathe out, that's not me anymore. And it just is such a, you know, pointer to the reality that whole idea of self is a construction. Because if, you know, there, it can't be that this air out here is not me until it goes inside me. And then it becomes me, you know, that, and then I breathe out. You just see that it's like, that's not a reasonable way to view self or to view reality. And so we start to break down conceptually this idea of self, of a separate self, of a separate independent self. So I'll leave it at that and see if there are any thoughts or comments anyone wants to add today or any questions. All right. Everybody's got the information they need. I see there was a question about James Barr's Awakening Joy. Yes, that's right. So thank you, Susan, for that. Bill, hi.
Oh, hi, Kevin. Hey, this brings a lot of stuff. Just by talking about Scoop, as I'll call him.
Yeah.
During your dissertation here, you know, I brought out a lot of memories for me growing up in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s, getting the firsthand feeling of underground radio.
Yeah.
Which KSAN got a little more, you know, mainstream after a while. But in the early days, you know, Scoop would come up and do his news and put a spin on it that nobody else was doing.
Yeah.
You know, and I loved his comment. And at the end of every news segment he did, he says, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. And that was part of the deal. Anyway, I just got an email just recently from Spirit Rock, and there's going to be a benefit for him on the 29th, I believe, of this month at Spirit Rock. And it's both online, or it's actually on land. I'm actually considering going out there.
You know, I'll be there.
Oh,
cool. I'll be on stage.
Oh, wow. Maybe there's another reason for me to go out there. I don't know. But, you know, apparently he's hit a little bit of a skid in his health wise. And it's kind of a benefit for him to some extent, you know. And I know Jack's going to be there, Jack Kornfield.
Yeah.
And I think Joseph Goldstein's going to come in on video.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd throw that out there. If you can't make it out there, but you can look at it online if you want to. Spirit Rock. So
thank you, Bill. It's such a reminder of how bad I am at promoting things. Like, yeah, of course. I meant to mention that. Yes. That'll be wonderful. And you sent me that great video from the last night of Winterland.
Winterland, right. Yeah. And I think I might have been there, but in those days it was pretty hazy. So
yeah. Oh, really? And Wes Scoop was on TV for that, you know, for that video of him interviewing people. Yeah. I just saw him, went to visit him last week. His health is not good at all. Yeah. And he's just turned 80, and sometimes that doesn't work so well. If you can come to that live or not, or on Zoom, definitely do. Something else that Wes is known for is writing music, songs like the Buddha Blues, his most famous one. It's on January 29th. It's on the Spirit Rock website, and part of, you know, he, as I suggested, you know, he became something of a mentor for me and a friend, and that it was his group that I first taught when I started to teach Dharma in the 90s. It was at his group that I first started to teach, and in any case, he writes music, and, you know, I started recording backing tracks for him because he would do these live shows. And so I'm going to do some music. I'm not sure if he's really going to be up to singing, but if not, I'll, you know, somehow muddle through and sing one or two of his songs at that event. So I'm really delighted to be be able to go to that. And you know, I haven't been to Spirit Rock in 3 years, so be my first time back since February of 2020. So yeah, maybe Monica, you could find that link to the Spirit Rock, to that event. Just go to the Spirit Rock website, and it should be on the, if it's not on the front page, it'll be on the calendar.
I was looking, but someone else found it. Thank you.
Oh, someone else. Oh, yeah, there it is. Sorry. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
So much. John. Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate it. That's great. Yeah. And that'll be fun. If you ever get a chance to go to Spirit Rock for an event like this, it's different from the like retreats and things where it's just teachings. This is a very social there will often be a multiple teachers sort of just walking around that you can chat with, and it's very fun to be able to be in a less formal sort of environment at that center. So any other thoughts or questions? I'll mention that I'm going to be tonight, I'm doing the Boulder, Colorado meditation group. I'm looking at you, Monica.
Oh, wow. Tonight?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to give a talk on living kindness.
That's Insight. Insight Boulder. Insight.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll look for it. I mean, you're obviously not in Colorado, but.
I am not. It'll be on Zoom. And it goes from 6 to 10, and they have a full period of meditation. The talk will begin at more like 7. So if you just want to come for the talk, you can do that, I think. I'm going to give a talk on living kindness, which, you know, as you know, my book that's been re-released. And then this Friday will be the Spirit Rock night. So if you are looking for me on Friday night, you won't find me on this Zoom account. I always feel bad that some people sign in here and go, "What's going on? Where's Kevin?" And there's no way to leave like a message. That's something Zoom should do, create a thing where you could just like leave a message on your site or something. Anyway,
this Friday, Spirit
Rock. What's that?
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Last week, I was a couple minutes late jumping in, and it said it was closed. And I was curious, is that something that's normal? Because it seemed as though people were able to get in after.
Oh, was that last Tuesday?
Yeah.
Was that the day we got the Zoom bomb, Monica? Yes. Yeah, somebody came in saying inappropriate things, and we booted them out and then closed the meeting so they wouldn't get back in.
Okay.
It was a very unusual circumstance. In 3 years, we've only had that happen twice. So hopefully it never happens again.
Sorry about that. Well, I'm going to learn to isolate people too, so we can unlock the meeting, since we have such strict protocols already.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for asking, David. That was unfortunate. You can write a message in waiting room, says Debbie. But the thing is that I can't be on the Spirit Rock Zoom, and also I'd have to, you know, have a different login probably to have both Zooms going on at once on the same computer. I don't know. Well,
I believe you can you can create a message, a waiting room for your meetings, because I know you have your meetings set up, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 for a certain period of time, right?
Right, right.
So you can create a message in the waiting room. They only allow you a certain number of words, but it will only apply, I believe, to that meeting. I could check it out a little bit more for you if you like.
All right, sure. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks. All right. Well, in any case, those are the upcoming events tonight. And then I'm also this Sunday, I'm at the San Francisco Gay Buddhist Fellowship. If you are in the area, and you can come to that online as well. Wonderful group. So yeah, I'm just looking at my calendar to see if I've got anything else I should tell you about. Going to the dermatologist. No, that's not, you don't care. Sorry. No, that looks like it. Vermont Insight on the 28th. Wow, I've got a busy month. All right, but I'll let you know about that when it's coming. It's a half day event. So as a takeaway today, I'm going to just suggest that you, you know, pay attention to your body as something that's just a manifestation of evolution, and what that might mean and what the implications of that are. So that's your takeaway for this Tuesday. And I wish you all well. Those in the, well, pretty much most of North America is under some kind of weather catastrophe. So I hope everybody stays safe and warm and dry. Be well. Peace.